Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present writer Nadia Hijab, who takes a critical look at the Middle East peace plan recently announced by President Bush, Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine, who assesses the White House and Pentagon's new first strike military doctrine, and Shelley Jubal of Connecticut Voices for Children, who explains how a proposed millionaire's tax could avert massive cuts in social spending as one of the wealthiest states faces hard choices to balance its budget. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Three years after the U.S. finally cut off aid to the Indonesian military due to human rights abuses in East Timor, the Bush administration is now looking to restore military ties in its expanding war on terrorism. Urged on by Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, a leading administration hawk and former ambassador to Indonesia, George W. Bush is seeking $16 million in anti-terrorism aid for Indonesia, the world's largest Muslim nation. Half of the funds would create a rapid response force, and the rest would train the National Police in counterterrorism. According to the Christian Science Monitor, leading U.S. senators such as Patrick Leahy of Vermont are resisting the drive to restore military ties with Indonesia, which has a long history of human rights abuses. Several senators are also looking to boost aid to the newly independent East Timor. Michael Ignatieff, a human rights expert at Harvard University, observed, "After September 11th, the environment has gotten much tougher for human rights principles. Does the focus on national security really justify supplying arms to anyone who waves the flag in our faces?" he asks. Many human rights monitors question how much Indonesian President Megawati Sukarno-Putri is committed to reforming the military. There has been little effort to bring top officers to justice for the killings in East Timor, and observers say that more abuses are being committed in other rebellious provinces. At the moment, groups like Human Rights Watch fear that there are few people in the Pentagon and the White House who worry about human rights when looking for allies in the war on terrorism. The Nation magazine reports that Sinn Féin, long associated with the Irish Republican Army, made significant gains in the Irish Republic's recent election by winning 5 seats in the Dublin Parliament. Sinn Féin surprised the Irish political establishment by effectively resisting the campaign by business leaders to make Ireland a Celtic tiger. The left-leaning party had opposed the Treaty of Nice that would have expanded the European Union. The treaty had been rejected by Irish voters in a June 2001 referendum. Sinn Féin campaigned to expand the public health service, create jobs, and provide social services for those Irish citizens left behind in the recent economic boom supported by American investment seeking cheap labor. Now, by teaming up with the Irish Green Party, Sinn Féin is leading the opposition to U.S.-style globalization. Irish Prime Minister Bertie Ahern is no fan of Sinn Féin, saying the party cannot be part of a coalition government until the IRA formally disbands. The political lines were drawn starkly in the race for the North Kerry district. That is where Martin Ferry, a former IRA gunrunner who went on a 47-day hunger strike in the late 1970s, defeated Dick Spring of the Labour Party, who served as the Irish foreign minister in the late 90s. It was a bitter race, as the state police arrested and roughed up Ferry. But it did not affect Sinn Féin's appeal, as their platform advocating social justice won the day. 11 years ago, Sherry Chapman, an inmate at the California Institution for Women, felt a lump in her breast. She went to the prison doctor but got rebuffed. It took her 2 years to get a mammogram. And after a follow-up test 2 years later, an outside doctor recommended a radical mastectomy and the removal of 4 lymph nodes. But that was not the end of Chapman's ordeal. She was shackled in a hospital waiting room, and later guards took away her painkillers. Soon the cancer spread, and Chapman was forced to have a second mastectomy. One of Chapman's lawyers, Ellen Berry, of Legal Services for Prisoners with Children, told The Nation magazine, "People would see this in another country and think of it as a human rights violation, but this is in our own backyard." According to prisoner advocates, female inmates often receive substandard health care and obtain faulty diagnoses and treatment in cases of reproductive and breast cancer. Critics complain that prison doctors are systematically overworked and poorly trained. Women inmates routinely need more medical care than male prisoners, suffer from uncoordinated and underfunded care, and little access to courts in cases of medical malpractice and neglect. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau. ¶¶
While Israeli troops reoccupied large swaths of the West Bank in reaction to recent suicide bombings, President Bush announced that the U.S. would support the establishment of a Palestinian state in the next 3 years, but only if Yasser Arafat is removed from power. He called for Palestinian legislative elections by the end of the year, a new constitution, economic reform, and reorganization of Palestinian security forces. In his June 24th address, Mr. Bush also asked Israel to stop building new settlements in the West Bank and Gaza and an eventual pullback to borders established before the 1967 Arab-Israeli War. But the president's demand that Arafat be removed from power as a condition for the creation of a Palestinian state was greeted with anger by many Palestinians. Others in the Arab world criticized Mr. Bush's proposal for its lack of a specific timetable and uneven pressure on the Palestinians. Israeli officials, while quite pleased with the speech which echoed Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's own demand that Arafat be deposed, nevertheless rejected the White House call for a provisional Palestinian state over the next 18 months. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with writer Nadia Hijab, who takes a critical look at the Bush peace plan and discusses what she believes must be part of any future peace agreement for it to be successful.
I don't see how any people in the world can be made responsible for democracy and a flourishing economy and peace and security for its neighbors until its land is actually freed. So I think it's really putting the cart before the horse. I think the occupation has to end first, 35 years after it began, and then you get on to the rest of the stuff. I think for the last several weeks, we've seen a very unhealthy obsession with Yasser Arafat, which to my mind serves to distract the attention from the occupation. I mean, we're in a situation where the tanks are reoccupying Ramallah and other major Palestinian cities, which were given back to the Palestinians after Oslo. But that kind of gave people the impression that the Israeli occupation was over. The occupation is far from over, so it's not a matter of just reoccupying the cities. You've got about 42% of the West Bank controlled by Israel, filled with settlements. You've got 400,000 Israelis in buildings on land stolen from the Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza, and to supposedly protect them. I mean, we're talking stolen land here. To protect this land, you've got Israeli armed forces in all the time. I mean, so that when they go into the cities, it's not like they were ever very far from the cities. They've been surrounding the cities. And you've got a whole series of roads built up, carving up the land so that the Palestinians can't move. And during the whole Oslo peace process, the situation of the average Palestinian actually became much worse. So, I mean, I think the focus on Arafat and reform and elections and the security forces is really sidetracked from the key issue of the occupation, the fact that the Palestinian land is being taken away, the water resources are being used, and they simply do not have their freedom. They're not free to move around. They're not free. Just the other day, they thought the curfew was lifted in Jenin. They went out shopping, and three kids and a 60-year-old man were shot dead. So these are people who've been living under curfew. And when we say under curfew, it's not like dusk to dawn curfew. It's like 23 hours a day curfew for months and months and years and years.
The United States and Israel somehow have it in their minds that the Palestinian people will elect more moderate leadership, more malleable leadership, open to more compromise with the U.S. and Israeli point of view. But what do you think will happen? Might not the Palestinian people elect more radical, more militant leadership?
Well, I mean, I don't see how the Palestinians can even leave the house to get to any election point. They're under curfew, you know, with Israel controlling every single aspect of daily life. You have resentments and frustrations building up, and you have people that are going to explode, and you have so-called accidents that can happen where people get shot dead by mistake or where people are assassinated by the Israeli forces. I mean, so long as you have the Israeli forces in the West Bank and Gaza, there's going to be a situation of violence and turmoil. So I don't even see how elections can take place. So that's why I say that they're a sideshow, whereas the real issue should be to end the occupation. I mean, pull out the Israeli soldiers and settlers, then put an international force between Israel and the Palestinian territories, then by all means have elections, and then hold the elected Palestinian leadership accountable for Israel's security, for democracy in Palestine, for, you know, relations with its neighbors. But while the occupation is ongoing, I don't think you can hold anyone accountable for security and democracy.
Does the Bush administration have the capability here to intervene and force some compromise on the part of Israel so that the peace process can be established and the violence can end?
Well, I think it certainly does. I mean, the polls in the United States show that the American people have a much more nuanced understanding of what's going on than is represented in Congress or by the administration, and that they would like to, they believe the Palestinians have rights to a state, and, you know, that they would like their government to have an even-handed approach to the conflict. The Bush administration and its predecessors that have provided military funding, military aid to Israel, and enabled it to buy really advanced American weaponry, which is the weaponry that's now being used in the occupied territories to demolish homes and to assassinate leaders, and that is helping escalate the cycle of violence. I mean, I think a halt to military aid would very quickly bring both sides to the table and would come to a fair solution. All the United States has to do is apply resolutions that it itself has approved, like Resolution 242, which was unanimously approved, and the other resolutions applying to the conflict, which have been approved by the United States and, for that matter, by Israel.
What do you foresee for the Bush peace plan proposal? Is it going to go anywhere? Is it a dead end? Can it be merged with the Saudi peace plan? Is there any hope that this can be part of something that will lead to the end of the violence?
Well, I mean, I wish I could see hope. I mean, there are some moving statements in it, and there are some determined language in there, but it puts everything at the end of a process of reform and democratization, whereas the problem really is the occupation. And until that issue is addressed, nothing is going to guarantee Palestinian human rights or Israeli security.
That was writer Nadia Hijab. For other perspectives on the Middle East conflict, visit the website at www.intheoccupation.org. Speaking at commencement exercises at the West Point Military Academy on June 1st, President Bush dismissed the Cold War doctrine of containment and deterrence as irrelevant and instead called for the U.S. to adopt a new first-strike military policy. Many observers regarded this pronouncement as part of a White House strategy to prepare the American public for a future U.S. war against Iraq, which is widely expected to be launched in the coming months. These changes are necessary, White House and Pentagon officials say, to destroy weapons of mass destruction held by nations which may in the future transfer them to terrorist groups. This newly announced doctrine of preemptive armed intervention, combined with Washington's unilateral abandonment of a number of important global treaties and conventions, has many diplomats from around the world persuaded that the U.S. has taken on the role of an arrogant empire to whom international law no longer applies. In recent years, the U.S. has rejected or abrogated agreements that include the Kyoto Convention on Climate Change, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, and the establishment of an international criminal court. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine, who assesses the Bush administration's first-strike military doctrine and how the rest of the world now perceives the U.S. in the aftermath of the September 11th terrorist attacks.
I think we're entering a whole new and very dangerous period where the United States views itself as unrestrained and unconstrained by international treaties, by constitutional law, and by any other government around the world that could act as a counterbalance. And so now you have the Bush administration talking about this doctrine of preemption, whereby it arrogates to itself the power and the authority to go attack any country anywhere in the world that may be acquiring weapons of mass destruction. That country may not necessarily be threatening the United States with an attack, but the Bush administration thinks it can go attack it anyway. This is the arrogance that Western diplomats, and I've got to believe that millions upon millions, even billions of people around the world, view properly as U.S. arrogance. And what scares me the most is not even the illegality of the doctrine, actually, though that I find appalling. The thing that scares me the most is the number of human beings that are likely to be killed, innocent human beings destroyed by a U.S. preemptive attack that may very well include the use of nuclear weapons. Really, for the first time since Ronald Reagan's first term, the United States is contemplating the use of nuclear weapons first. And here, not in a big, massive assault on the Soviet Union, as was the case during the Reagan years and also in the Cold War, but now against a third world country or against a terrorist, but most likely against Iraq. And what is the logic of it? Iraq does not have weapons of mass destruction that can reach the United States, certainly by intercontinental ballistic missiles. Iraq was not involved in the acts of September 11th. And for the United States to threaten to overthrow the regime of Saddam Hussein or to act in some so-called preemptive effort and attack him either with the CIA or with the full force of the Pentagon, that, you know, is going to end up killing tens of thousands, maybe more Iraqis, on top of the how many hundreds of thousands of Iraqis have been killed by the U.S. during the war and during the sanctions that followed. I mean, I am really kind of appalled at the arrogance, at the hubris of empire, of the hubris of the Bush administration, and even, really, it makes me uncomfortable, the hubris of those of us here in the empire who can contemplate or even discuss, you know, which country should we or should we not attack next. No other country in the world has that disgusting luxury. No other people in the world can sit down and say, well, maybe our country should attack this other country tomorrow and not feel any risk of punishment or corresponding damage.
There are many in the executive branch, Congress, and certainly the public at large who feel that this kind of aggressive stand on the part of our country and our military is necessary to prevent a repeat of the September 11th attacks and make sure that weapons of mass destruction don't wind up in the hands of terrorists. How do you respond to that, which is pretty much the whole rationale for this new doctrine?
If the U.S. government knew that Mohammed Atta and Osama bin Laden were planning an imminent attack on the United States, then the U.S. government would be justified under international law to go attack Osama bin Laden and to go attack Mohammed Atta. And my problem is, I think it should be done constitutionally. There should be a declaration of war, and boom, they should go get him. But leaving that aside, I don't think that really is the issue right now, attacking terrorists. If the U.S. government finds terrorists who have an imminent threat of attacking the United States, they're justified. The U.S. is justified already under existing law without this whole preemption doctrine of going after them. So I don't think it's necessary. And in a way, it's kind of covering up for the huge intelligence failure that the government is embarrassed about and should be embarrassed about. I don't think that's the issue. The issue is blatant U.S. projection of power around the world unchecked. That's what Bush wants. He doesn't want to be constrained by Congress or by the U.N. or by any big power. I mean, Russia already is along for the ride.
You think that this thing will backfire, this new U.S. attitude will backfire, and that coalitions of nations will gather to oppose and resist U.S. hegemony?
My biggest concern is that it's not going to backfire until there's another nuclear holocaust, not of the scale of a nuclear winter, but of the scale of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. At this point, I don't see a force on Earth that can contain or confine or talk reason to Washington. George W. Bush, this immensely powerful man with a middling mind and a lazy intellect, you know, can do just about whatever he wants because the United States has the power. And that's the bottom line. It doesn't matter whether Britain and France and Russia got together and say, you know, don't do this, we don't want you to do this. Because ultimately, Bush doesn't really give a rip. And he will do what he wants to do and what his advisors tell him to do. And so my fear is that this recklessness will end with a mushroom cloud over Baghdad. And at that point, the world will recoil in horror. And I hope it doesn't come to that. And there are ways to stop it. The ways to stop it are for U.S. citizens to stop it. We alone have the power to resist this kind of really dangerous recklessness. And we do so in the ways that we know how to here in the social justice movement. We do so nonviolently, but militantly, to oppose through letters and calls and protests, demonstrations, this heedless march to war.
That was Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive magazine. Contact The Progressive by calling area code 608-257-4626 or visit their website at www.theprogressive.org. Like many other states, Connecticut is wrestling with a massive budget deficit, almost $1 billion on a budget of $13.5 billion. But unlike other states, Connecticut is once again number one in terms of per capita income in the U.S., according to the latest census data. Research by the nonprofit group Connecticut Voices for Children shows that during the 1990s, the income gap between the state's poorest and wealthiest families increased dramatically, with the poor getting poorer and the rich getting much richer. So a new coalition called One Connecticut, made up of dozens of social service and social justice groups in the state, proposed a temporary millionaire's tax as the most equitable way to help close the budget deficit. The tax consisted of a 1% surcharge on personal income over $1 million that would be imposed for 2 years. A budget that incorporated the tax was approved by the Democrat-controlled state legislature, but vetoed by Governor John Rowland, a Republican. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Shelley Jubal, co-director of Connecticut Voices for Children, about the state's budget woes and who is likely to suffer in one of the nation's wealthiest states if program cuts are made to balance the budget.
What's really important to remember about Connecticut is that we have consistently enjoyed the highest per capita income of any state in the nation. And over the 1990s, a report that we did looking at census data showed that the top 20% of Connecticut families enjoyed very substantial gains in income, 21% gain in income. And importantly, the census data used in that report don't even count the capital gains income. So if one were to count that, it would have been even far larger than that. But by comparison, people in the bottom 40% of families in the state actually lost income adjusted for inflation. And so as we've approached the dilemma of how do we have a balanced budget both this year and next year, you know, the obvious question is who bears the burden of balancing the budget, because our Constitution requires a balanced budget. And like a family, a budget can be balanced by cutting expenses or increasing income or a combination of both. And what the fair share budget that the One Connecticut Coalition is espousing, which Connecticut Voices played a large role in putting together, one of a key component of it is a tax, an increase of 1% over a two-year period on the income tax of income over $1 million. It would affect about 6,500 taxpayers, and these are taxpayers who enjoyed very great income growth over the 1990s that will be enjoying federal tax cuts, income tax cuts, and who can deduct the increased state tax off their federal income tax. We view that and changing some of the corporate tax code to increase the burden on the corporate taxes, who've also enjoyed great benefit over the 1990s, as a far better option than cutting programs and services for people who need them to go and stay in the workforce. So much of the state budget is not really discretionary spending. We spend about 11% of our budget paying off our state debt, and just like the bank isn't patient with you not paying off your mortgage, nor are the people who lend the state money patient with us not paying off our debt. About 20% of the state budget is for Medicaid, and interestingly, about 3/4 of that money goes to support elderly and disabled people. Obviously, that's not really discretionary spending either, and a lot of other money isn't either. And so where we see cuts is in aid to schools, which would increase our local property taxes, and in other programs, which, though viewed as discretionary in a state budget sense, certainly are not discretionary to the lives of the people who rely on those programs.
Has the governor given any indication of, has he mentioned specific programs that he would cut, or has he also mentioned specific things beyond the non-discretionary spending?
Well, in the budget that he proposed for this upcoming year, which was obviously prepared by the governor's office well before the deficit grew as fast as it did, one of the major areas of cutting was in aid to municipalities for education, both special education grants and aids to education and the like. Those were some of the cuts restored by the Democrats' budget, which the governor then vetoed. But that was a primary area of cutting.
The budget was passed by the House and the Senate with a so-called millionaire's tax included. Were you surprised that it did pass? Was that really a radical notion, or seemed like a lot of legislators would not necessarily support that?
We had a sort of a running pool in the office about whether it would be included in the Democrats' budget or not, but I actually don't think it's a radical notion. I mean, our top bracket income tax rate is well below that of neighboring states. We have very high income, as I mentioned, in this state, and so when one's looking at who bears the burdens best, it's a very logical place to go in order to find revenues and to avoid cuts in programs that would disproportionately burden lower and middle income families. And so it's a logical thing, and so in that sense it shouldn't be viewed as necessarily heroic. But I have to say that there were some in this office that were surprised that the budget included it.
The governor's running for re-election in the fall. Do you see this as being an issue over which he might suffer some damage if he does not either come up with his own budget that does not include cuts, or if he just doesn't do anything and the budget for 2003 fiscal year does go into effect?
Well, I think that there obviously is potential for damage to the governor. In the sense that if the budget goes into effect in 2003, his having rejected an optional budget that would have been much closer to being in balance, he will be the one who will be forced to begin to make cuts, and it will be on his watch that potentially state employees are laid off, that essential services begin to be cut, that aid to town is cut, and our local property taxes go up. And it could be painted in a political context that to protect the interests of 6,500 wealthy taxpayers, the governor prefers to make all of these draconian cuts. And that could become an election issue, clearly.
That was Shelley Jubal of Connecticut Voices for Children. The group can be contacted at area code 203-498-4240 or visit their website at www.ctkidslink.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikita. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Sasha Summer Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.